The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
I'm delighted to welcome Marcel van der Heijden, partner at Fortino, a leading B2B software venture capital and growth equity firm, investing in both early and mid-cycle B2B SaaS businesses, onto today's episode. So Marcel, welcome to the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan.
Thank you very much, Gary. Thanks for the opportunity.
Just to kick things off, there were huge boom times really in B2B SaaS funding, especially 2020, 2021, probably the earlier part of 2022. And over the past 12, 18 months, valuations have been pushed back. B2B SaaS funding has been challenging to raise. It's been harder to raise funds and harder for companies to access funding. How has your portfolio adapted to these recent challenges?
Looking a bit more back, you know, when Speedless started, was it 2011, you know, up to COVID, I think the market was good, was growing continuously. So it was a good time to start a fund, obviously. Then when COVID hit, and I remember it very well, I think it was March 16, we sent a letter. I was still at Speedinvest at the time. We sent a letter to March 16, 2020, then sent a letter to the portfolio saying, drop everything you do, you know, cut costs, let people go. It was kind of a, you know, red alert type of letter. And many funds were doing this, by the way. It's not just us. And so very quickly after that, the market took off again. So it was a kind of a 6 month period.
About 90 days later.
Well, yeah, so not very long. So it was a stressful period, but it didn't last very long. So, you know, after that, obviously the market took off like in an irrational way. So when I joined Fortino, you know, it was mid-2021, the market was still booming and it was, you know, literally no end in sight, let's say. And that quickly changed after I joined. I think we did what most funds did. It took a little while to really sink in, but again, very quickly, we went back to old portfolio companies and said, let's figure out a way to create 2 years of runway, 2 years plus of runway, which for some companies was easier to do. Maybe they just raised a good round and, you know, had a good balance sheet. For other companies was, you know, very tough timing, because they were planning to raise. And so we did a lot of work in 2022 and still in 2023 to shore up the balance sheet, to get costs under control, to make sure everybody had, you know, price indexing in their contracts, which, you know, nobody ever thought about, you know, in the years before that. And so we did a lot of those kind of get the basics right. Then, you know, in some cases, we have to support the companies. We have further financing. Those are tough decisions. You know, who do you support? How much do you support them? You have to rethink in some cases, you know, the future trajectory of the company. Can this company still, what is a possible growth rate given the market situation, given the financial situation? So there's a lot of work happening in the portfolio, a lot of tough decisions, tough discussions with founders, but also created opportunities for us in the sense that we have companies in the portfolio that are doing well, where we have a lot of confidence in the founding team, and actually extending funding wasn't a matter of, you know, trying to save the company. It was really continuing to invest in a company that was actually doing well throughout a period when the market wasn't doing well, but customers were still buying and they were still selling. When they're doing that in a capital efficient manner, at still, you know, 100+% year over year growth rates, it's actually not a difficult decision to, you know, continue to invest. And so we've done that in a few cases. We were able to double down on companies, avoid the founders having to go back to the market and spend 9 months fundraising, and just, you know, allow them to be able to their heads down again and continue to build the business. So a lot of work, but also some great opportunities came out of that.
And we're now into early April 2024. Has the funding situation stabilized for B2B software and SaaS?
Yeah, if you look at the numbers, I think the Q1 numbers came out or coming out kind of around this time. I think the overall amount of funding has stabilized. The number of deals is still going down, meaning that the rounds that get done tend to be a little bit larger, and the valuations are actually not. So we invest in seed and Series A, and the valuations in that segment of the market haven't been impacted as much as, you know, Series B, C, D, and so forth. So the deals that we're seeing, and we're, let's say, in the last quarter, we've seen an increase in quality. We haven't seen a big decrease in valuations. I think the level of capital that's being invested is kind of back to pre-COVID days, and it's kind of back to normal in that sense. That's how we think about it. So there's capital, investors are investing, but they've raised the bar in terms of what is investable, for example.
And what about the pure play AI companies? Do you invest in those as well if they've got a SaaS angle? And what about the valuations in that area?
We invest in, let's call it applied AI. So we wouldn't invest in companies that are building foundational models. We tend to look mostly at AI applied, AI taken to market as a SaaS service. There's a product as a service that does a thing. We're definitely very interested in looking at companies that apply AI to improve, a certain task or a certain service. The valuations there tend to be, I don't see unusual valuations in those kind of applied AI SaaS companies. We do see many of them actually doing quite well. And there's kind of, we think about it in two ways. On the one hand, I do believe there is a kind of a lot, almost secular investment wave, investment cycle that has started, where organizations are investing in AI-driven solutions simply because they see that those can bring new capabilities to the table that they can benefit from. On the other hand, we're seeing some more opportunistic behavior among customers too, as a sales leader, as a customer care, responsible person in an organization or procurement leader. You're going to get the question like, what are we doing with AI? And telling your CEO, well, nothing, that's probably not a good answer. There's a opportunistic kind of, shorter term level of investment with customers. They're very keen to try things out. And that's great news for startups. We also think that that's the start of part of a longer, more secular investment cycle in AI.
Now, you mentioned when we last spoke that as a fund, as a VC, you've got a choice. You can focus either on creating more winners or fewer losers. And that you'd somehow shifted in recent times to focusing on fewer losers. Can you walk me through what that means to the way you and your colleagues engage with your existing portfolio companies?
If you look at how funds perform and the best performing funds, it's absolutely driven by big winners. Right? You cannot have a very good performing fund if you do not have one or two or more large winners. So that is still, a priority for us. The question then is, what about the rest of them, the rest of the portfolio? And it's a bit of a paradox generally in venture where, you tend to spend a lot of time with the companies that struggle or have challenges, and the companies that are doing super, super well also tend to be the companies where you don't need to spend a lot of time. They're not asking often for a lot of help. When they do ask, you better respond and you better have a good response. But in terms of time spent, the best performers tend to be fairly hands-off. we do spend a lot of time with all of our portfolio. We tend to really try to not write off companies. And I think every investor does that. But I think it's important because, you know, it's probably going to, those kind of companies still are going to return the fund once, you know, maybe more in the course of the lifetime of the fund. So we spend a lot of time thinking about how can we find a soft landing for our company? How can we find a home for our company? I think at Fortino especially, this may be the result of let's say the private equity DNA we have in the fund or in the fund manager. We, you know, we run a separate private equity fund. So we have a lot of transactional experience. We have a big network among advisors. And I think Fortino has proven to be very good at exiting. A lot of investors are good investors. And they're not necessarily very deliberate when it comes to creating exits or creating liquidity for their LPs. And I think we're very good at it. If I think about 2020 and 2021, we exited a very big chunk of our first venture fund, 2016 fund, to the point where, you know, we only have two active companies in that fund left. So we created a lot of liquidity when the market was ready for it. And we were able to tap into that opportunity. And I think some funds didn't kind of take that opportunity. You know, they saw their TVPI grow, but not necessarily their DPI in a period when it was probably the optimal period to create DPI.
Can you run me through those acronyms and just explain what they mean?
Yeah, so TVPI is basically the book value of your portfolio. You know, what is your portfolio worth if somebody were to buy it? The DPI is the actual distributions back to your fund investors that you've been able to create. So DPI is cash back to investors in the fund. And 20 and 21 was a great time to fundraise, but it was also a great time to exit. And we've done, I think, more exits than other funds. And so we were able to return capital back to our investors at the best possible time. Today, the M&A environment is a bit more challenging, let's say.
You were talking a few moments ago about the companies that were struggling and might need a bit more input from you and your colleagues. But of course, you pretty much always co-invest with other funds. And I'm wondering how that works out. So if you've got a struggling company in the portfolio, and does that ever spill over into tension between the investors who've got different views on the best way to safeguard the portfolio company's future?
Can be. So that's part of the game is, you know, working with your co-investors, other members in the board, including the founders, to come up with the best way forward for the company. So it's not us or, you know, any shareholder dictating what needs to happen. That is a conversation that you're having together. That's part of the job.
What advice do you have for startups, for founders, to optimize the probability of achieving a good exit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of times people, founders, but also the board, you know, they tend not to think much about exits, and they think about it only when, you know, when there's maybe, you know, an acquisition offer or, you know, somebody expresses interest along those lines, or when there's really no other option for the company, or the number of options, you know, to raise additional capital and to grow becomes more limited. I like to think that it's actually a good idea to always, you know, first of all, when you invest, you should know, or you should have an idea how to exit a company or to whom to exit a company, right? And obviously things change, but most investors will have kind of a thesis or an hypothesis around that. But I think it's always good to periodically revisit the topic and think about that assumption that we had, you know, together with the founders and together maybe with co-investors, you know, how to grow the company and then how to exit it. The assumptions on which that was based, is that still valid? You know, did the market change? Maybe in terms of access to capital, competition, And what does that mean for our initial, you know, ideas around exiting? That's a good discussion to have. It aligns with, you know, thinking about competition. How's the competition fundraising? You know, are the large competitors there being bought by PE? And so they may come to the market. And if they are not buying you, are they buying your competitors? And so it's like, how is that field potentially, you know, how can that field potentially evolve? Is it a good discussion to have every 6 months, maybe every year in the early stage? I think for founders, it's actually a good idea to start to build meaningful relationships early on with potential acquirers. You know, sometimes these are commercial partners that can deliver, you know, short-term commercial impact, but also longer-term, you know, liquidity opportunities or exit opportunities. So building those relationships, even getting to know your competitors and just knowing the CEO of some of your competitors and, you know, have a, let's say, a line of communication or a potential line of communication. The same goes for advisors. If you are in the cybersecurity space or in the fintech market, it's not a bad idea to build relationships with the top, I don't know, X advisors that either do sell side or buy sides, and just have informal discussion, you know, every couple of months, understand how they see the market, learn from them how they expect things to evolve in the next 6 months or year. You know, what does the M&A landscape look like, you know, in that specific sector? I think those are all kind of relationships. It's not a huge investment of time, but you get information about your market, and it creates a lot of potential in the future when you maybe decide to sell your company, when you get an acquisition offer and you need to respond quickly. So are we going to look at this offer? Are we going into a process? Are we going to start a competitive process? Do we need an advisor? When those discussions have to start from scratch, you lose a lot of time. You might be forced to make decisions quickly and then suboptimally.
I'd love to hear about your most recent investment and the investment thesis that enticed you to invest in that company.
We invested and we announced the investment recently in a Dutch company called Altura. And Altura is an example of one of these kind of applied AI companies. So what Altura does, it's a fit management solution. And just to give you some context, there's a lot of organizations, typically larger organizations, that respond to RFPs, public tenders. And those processes of, you know, responding to an RFP or a public tender, you know, tend to be quite complex. The process of responding to them, you know, is typically managed by a bid manager in organization. And the bid manager is kind of like the traffic cop almost in the organization. So, you know, they get the documents in and they communicate with all the stakeholders to get information, you know, prepare an offer. You know, make sure everything gets signed off, everything's checked and double checked. These are processes that take weeks, sometimes months, and involve many different stakeholders. Today, it is often managed with email and spreadsheets. There's a Dropbox or SharePoint site with all the documents and all the versions and whatnot. And then there's a lot of emails and checklists, you know, who needs to provide what, you know, who needs to sign up, et cetera, et cetera. That process isn't optimal. And it's a process that I think lends itself well to a more structure, some way for that team. And these teams are not teams that interact every day. Like they interact on a kind of per opportunity basis, an opportunity for them to work better together, share information better, manage progress and status better. That's what Altura built on. Top of that, they're using generative AI capabilities to learn from all the previous tenders and RFPs they got and all the responses they've sent back and whether or not they won that deal. So response documents can be pre-populated with kind of best practices and recommendations from, let's say, successful bids. So if you need to, I don't know, describe your quality assurance process in an RFP response, you don't want people to kind of reinvent the wheel and start writing from scratch and start, you know, thinking about what that process might look like and how it might may need to be customized for that specific customer. It's much easier if you look at your last 3, 4, 5, whatever successful bits and pre-populate that part of the document and look at the authors of those sections in the previous document and say, well, can you please check this? And so you can have a process where you pre-populate responses and then you have a review process. All of this can then be automated. So it's a huge time saver, improves the quality of your responses and improves the probability of winning your bids.
And although things might change, in fact, they almost inevitably will change over the coming months and years, have you already sort of mapped out a path towards follow-on investors and eventual exit options?
There is a high-level path, of course. We have assumptions around that. Right now, we just made this investment. Right now, the priority really, this was a seed investment. And our main task, we think, is getting this company to a Series A stage in terms of revenue, but also like organization-wise and process-wise. So that's where we spend most of our thinking right now, to be honest. But yeah, there will be a moment where we have to think a little bit further and think about beyond Series A and look at the landscape again and see, you know, check whether that has changed and what it means for the company. But right now we're very, very kind of heads down with the founders.
Final question from me. Who are the three investors or entrepreneurs who've most inspired you and your approach to business and investing?
That's an interesting question. Let me start with founders. So when I joined Fortino invested in a company called Insider. And when I joined, the company was at a crossroads. It went through some quite difficult times. It had to pivot, did it well, did it successfully. And it wasn't clear if the company would be able to raise a Series B. And so, you know, we started discussions with the founder. He'd been doing it for, I think, almost 10 years, you know, through ups and downs. So, you know, there was an element of like, you know, how much, if I'm going to do this much longer, you know, it better be worth it. And so we ultimately decided to run a fundraise process and try to find out quickly if that had any legs. And if it looked like it wouldn't work, then run a dual track. So we basically run a dual track M&A fundraising process. The end of the story was that, you know, the company was sold to Gainsight. He joined Gainsight as chief strategy officer, spent 2 years. I think he just left. Well, I was just very happy that he had a good exit. As an investor, we also had a good exit. So that was great to see that all the hard work, you know, that he put in and all the change management and changes that he made, you know, worked out. So that was great to see. But it was also a good example of he built that relationship with Gainsight quite early on, and with others, by the way. So, you know, talking about the exit process and the relationships you can build years before that to facilitate, let's say, a smooth exit, I think that's a great example of somebody that did it really, really well.
So that's on the kind of entrepreneurial side. In terms of other investors, people who you look up to, who've inspired you and your approach?
Yeah, I think there's many investors. I spent my first years investing in, you know, in Silicon Valley. We were investing in Europe, but, you know, spent 6 years there. You really see the difference that, let's say, generations of entrepreneurs, generations of investors make in terms of the depth and the density of experience and let's say talent. You can just see it in, you know, when you're there. You know, in Europe, we're a little bit behind, but we're getting there too. I think we're already seeing, you know, young investors that are really super smart. To be specific, in the US, we worked a lot with NEA and people like Scott Sandell and Rick Yang. You know, were just an inspiration to be close to and kind of observe how they think about venture and how they think about companies. And then people like Bill Gurley, just super thoughtful about, you know, building companies, creating large opportunities. I think we have some work to do here in Europe, but we're getting there.
I bet you fondly remember those brunches and lunches down at Palo Alto downtown.
Yeah, it's pretty transactional, actually. You know, a dinner in the US, like an investor dinner, that's like, you know, 90 minutes tops, and then, you know, everybody moves on. But yeah, very, very interesting to see investors, let's say, at work.
Exactly. Well, it's been great listening to your journey and talking about some of the companies you've been involved with as well. Thank you so much for joining me on this week's episode of Startup to Scale Up Game Plan.
Absolutely. Thanks, Gary.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.